Our international tape library, Hermano Pablo Ministries, is pleased to present a message from our series, Prime Time Messages.
I have had tremendous miracles of God wrought in my own life and in my own body. I was in Bolivia for about 6 weeks in a series of meetings there, crusades there, and went there already with a definite, declared, photographed, and felt ulcer in the duodenal area of my stomach. I'd had it for 6 or 8 years. I'd lived for a long, long time on nothing but cream of wheat, morning, mid-morning, noon, mid-afternoon, evening, mid-evening, at 3 o'clock in the morning, and again for breakfast because of the ulcer. Ulcers are horrible things. The only thing it helped me was that it's kind of a status symbol, you know, for an executive to have ulcers, for whatever that meant. But it messed up my activity in preaching the gospel of Christ. And here I found myself now in Bolivia with this horrible ulcer and having to exercise certain amenities that included drinking coffee, which I shouldn't, and burnt me horribly each time, eating highly condimented foods, which I shouldn't, and burned me horribly each time, including such things as jalapeno peppers, etc., 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 ad infinitum, which is about all you get, you know. And I remember sitting down at the room that we were there in the missionary's home in La Paz, Bolivia, writing to my doctor and in Costa Mesa, saying, when I get home, I'm going to lay myself at your feet, and whatever has to be done to get rid of this ulcer, let's get rid of it. And that's the way I felt. But about a week before leaving Bolivia, got up one morning, had the coffee, which I did out of pure politeness. There are times when your sense of politeness overrules your sense of good health. And many times, just not to hurt people's feelings, I would do things that I know would harm me, and that was one. And lo and behold, it didn't burn the ulcer. There was no ulcer, at least no burn. As a matter of fact, I had a second cup of coffee, no burn. During the day, again, indulged, both because I like it, but really more than anything else because I didn't want to hurt people's feelings. Not wanting to hurt people's feelings is sometimes a fabulous cop-out for what you want to do anyhow, you know. No, but I was really nurturing an ulcer that was really bothering me, but no pain. The next day, no pain. The next day, no pain. I finished the crusade, no pain. I came home to the States, no pain. A couple of months afterwards, my wife was in to see my doctor, Jack, and he said, where's Paul? And she said, well, he's home, been home now for a month or so. And he said, well, how is it he hasn't come in to see me? I got this long, handwritten, scribbled that I could hardly read letter from him about the hardly could read had nothing to do with the ulcer. It said, anything that I write is hard to read. I'm surprised he hasn't been in to see me. And she said to him, well, he's fine. No problem. And he said, look, you tell him to come and see me. I want to see him anyhow. So I went in to see Jack, my doctor, and Jack says, Paul, the ulcer thing. Because we had already taken several x-rays of the ulcer. You go in, and I don't know if you've had the problem or not, but there's a chalk stuff that they give you called barium that is worse than the ulcer, and you go through this, you know, and then put you on this machine that lays you up and turns you upside down and all over, and this guy gets in front of you looking at you through a x-ray thing that he can actually see your stomach and punches, you know, as the stuff is going down to see where it's going. It's a big mess of a thing. And he said, Paul, he said, it's fantastic. You say no pain. That's great. But the only way that I'll believe it is by going through another series of exams to find out if it really is gone. I said, fine, I'll submit to it. which I did. Again, the barium and all that stuff, you know. A couple weeks later, he calls me in to tell me that my stomach is like the stomach of a newborn babe. Not only no ulcer, but the irritation absolutely gone, and the stomach in the healthiest state that it could possibly be. This is 10 years ago. I've had irritations in my stomach since that time, simply because I have mistreated my stomach. Whatsoever a man soweth, that shall he also reap, obviously, you know. But no ulcer. And my stomach is in good shape today, thank God. Many other things God has done for me. Now, I mention these facts because I want to bring out today another side of the story of what really faith is and how faith operates and where and when faith operates. And I have to read to you this morning the verse out of the faith chapter, out of the faith book in the Bible, which is obviously Hebrews 11:1, which simply reads in the King James Version, and I have to say that because there are so many today, all of which are good, incidentally. I don't have any hang-ups on that. Now, faith is the substance of things hoped for, the evidence of things not seen. And this, incidentally, is one of those verses of Scripture that we kind of slide over because it's rather incongruous. Doesn't make sense. In fact, apparently even contradictory. Substance. Faith is a substance that's this. Anything you can feel, smell, hear, taste, or see. This is substance. This is substance. This is substance. I mean, if you can feel of it or look at it or taste it or hear it or see it, it's substance. Or smell it, it's substance. Did I come up with six? Oh no, I mentioned the seeing twice. But here it says that faith is a substance of things hoped for. It hasn't yet materialized, and yet it's substance. It hasn't yet become physical, and yet it's substance. How can it be substance and not be physical yet? And should we not understand that one? It goes on to say that faith is the evidence. I have two brothers that are blind. They were born blind with infantile cataracts. If they were here this morning and I lifted this up and without saying what it was, referred to it and talked about it, they'd be lost because they couldn't see. They'd have to see for it to become some kind of an evidence for them regarding what I'm talking about. But Paul here says, I think Paul wrote Hebrews, that faith is the evidence of things not seen. Now, how can it be evidence and not be seen? There's a reason for it. It's because faith is one of those elusive things that when you have the result of it, you don't have it anymore. You can't have light and darkness at the same time. You can't have faith and the result of faith, the object of faith, at the same time. You don't need to trust once you have the thing that you have been trusting for. You don't need to have faith once you have the thing that you have been having faith for. Once the answer is in your hands, you don't need the faith anymore. Once the situation is solved, you don't need the faith anymore. Once you've got the thing already under control, you don't need the faith anymore. You need the faith when the thing is still out of control, when you don't know where you're going, when everything is black in front of you, when you feed it into the computer and the computer goes haywire, spitting out red lights and wires and things because it goes haywire. That's when you need faith. When everything is contrary to what you need, there's where faith comes in. When everything is flowing beautifully, not only do you not need faith, you cannot have faith for that thing which is already under control. Now that's fine and dandy, except for one thing. That, going down the line, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, Hebrews 11:6 says that without this elusive thing, that when you have it, you don't have it, called faith, it is impossible to please God. Which means that without those areas of deficit, of problem, of darkness, of difficulty, you don't have the necessary ground, the fertile area, the environment necessary, the situation necessary where faith can be exercised. And if you don't have the element where faith can be exercised, without faith, it is impossible to please God. Conclusion, without those areas of problem, not being able to have faith, it is impossible to please God. So problems are good for us. I mean, it's here. I'll never forget the story that I got from a man in Lima, Peru. We were there many years ago. This happened back about 1962 or something like that. And this was a communications congress. And about 6 o'clock in the morning, prayer meeting, we were gathered together, several pastors, ministers, missionaries, when one brother asked to speak. He was rather quiet by nature, very well dressed, a fine gentleman, brother in Christ that I didn't know up to that time, but he asked humbly and rather shyly if he could say something. And the one who was leading the conference said yes. So he got up and said this. He started out his words with a question. Is it possible that God is only the God of the poor? We didn't catch on. Actually, the question was meaningless to us until he explained what the question was about. He said, a few weeks ago, I was back visiting one of my properties. He was a large landowner in South America and had properties back in the hinterlands of Peru. And he said, I had to go in by on the back of a horse. There was no way of getting in there except on the back of a horse. And so I was in there visiting my properties, and lo and behold, I didn't realize it, because my properties are in the hands of people that handle the property. But on the property, one of the farmers living on the property, peons on the property, was a Christian. I knew it the minute I walked into his house, his little shack, a hut, because on the wall, mud wall, there were scripture texts. And this only happens in the house of evangelicals. So I knew he was a Christian. I said, you are a Christian. And the man said, as a matter of fact, yes, I am. Thank the Lord. And so they shook hands. Well, I am too. So here's the peon shaking hands with the proprietor of the whole property, both Christians. Something brought them together. Everything was fine until the proprietor discovered that in the home there was a little child, about 10, 12 years old, that was extremely sick. In fact, he went to see the baby or the young man that was on the cot, and he saw that the lad was dying, literally dying, eyes transfixed, very, very pale, hot, burning up with a fever, and just laying there, dying. And the owner said to the peon, he said, look, the young lad, what are you doing for him? Just giving him to the Lord every night before we go to bed. And the next morning there he is again. But he says, you got to do something for him. The young lad is dying. He's going to die on you here. You got to do something for him. Well, what can I do for him? We can't do anything for him. Well, you got to get him to a hospital or something. How can we do that? The first day out, he'll die of exposure alone. He couldn't take the back of a horse for 24 hours. Impossible. And so the man said, well, you've got to bring a doctor in here then. Well, how can we bring a doctor in here? That's impossible. In the first place, who would come? In the second place, how would we pay him? We exchange ourselves out here. We exchange our goods by bartering with goods. We don't have any money. Grains of corn become our money. There's no way that I can bring a doctor in here. And again, the owner then said, the property owner said, well, you've got to do something. Well, we are doing something. What is it you're doing? Well, every night, before we go to bed, we commend the child into God's care. And this has been going on now for 2 or 3 weeks. And the next morning, the lad has been there still. And that night, when they went to bed, the farmer called in the property owner and said, look, we've been doing every night. You're our guest. And you know the Lord. Would you mind tonight laying the child into God's hands to pass the night so that he'd be here again tomorrow morning? And the man said, I had never done that in all of my life. In the first place, he was from a congregation that didn't pray for the sick. And in the second place, he was wealthy enough to buy his healing whenever he got sick anyway. So praying for the sick was something unknown to him, at least unusual. And he didn't know what to do. And now he's saying this. He's telling this testimony this morning at the 6 o'clock in the morning prayer meeting at Lima, Peru, at the Communications Congress. And he says, "People, I didn't know what to do. I didn't know what to do. I felt like the man was laying to my charge the life of that young lad, and I didn't know what to do. I prayed and simply said, 'God, if you've ever answered a prayer in all of your life, answer this one.' You kind of pray differently," the man said, "when there's a life at stake that has been placed at your responsibility." And I cried out, I said, "Please, God, give this young lad life. Do something so he'll be here tomorrow morning again." And he said, "I finally went to bed, my hammock. Early hours in the morning, I finally halfway fell off to sleep to awaken again at 6 o'clock the next morning. First thing I did was ask about the young lad. 'How's the lad?' And the farmer said, 'He's fine.' 'What do you mean he's fine?' 'He's fine. He's outside playing with the other children.'" And the man said, "What do you mean outside playing with the other children? He hadn't been up in weeks." He got up quickly, went outside, and sure enough, the lad was still emaciated, walking slowly, very thin, but the fever had broken, and he was out laughing and smiling, not quite as bright and fast as the other ones, but playing with the other children outside. That, of course, was the beginning of his mend. In 3 or 4 days, he was fine. And now comes to the Congress this gentleman, and crying says, "Is it possible that God is only the God of the poor?" Do we have to be totally destitute of everything before God comes to our rescue? Well, let me give you the answer. Academically, no. Theologically, no. Scripturally, no. We don't have to be out of everything before God will come to our rescue. He's by our side day and night. We can live in the presence of the Lord day and night, whatever our situation and condition is. But in the practical sense, which all too many times varies from the mere academic sense, in the practical sense, unfortunately, for many of us, we've got to get to the total, absolute end of ourselves before we knock at God's door. Then we knock at the door, and sure enough, he's there. And the fact of the matter is, as the hymn goes, he was there all along. He was there all along. But somehow the tightness of a situation, the urgency of a situation, drives us toward him. And this is good for us. Faith is the substance of things that have not yet materialized. It is the evidence of things that are not seen. And without it, it is impossible to please God. Now, how do we handle it in a society such as is ours in the United States of America? And I speaking to the poorest of American people, the very poorest of American people, there is such a vast difference between just living here and living abroad in Latin America that there is absolutely no comparison. United States is a veritable paradise. The fact of the matter is that our doors are tumbling down. The doors of our frontier, our entrance doors, all around us are falling down by the bombardment of the millions of people that are knocking at it, trying to get in. Despite the fact that many of them, while they're knocking, are tearing down our political system, crying out for communism, still they're knocking at our doors, trying to get in. Why? Because they know that our system here, free enterprise system here, offers everybody, the poorest and the most unprepared, a challenge, at least an opportunity, a chance. So what has happened to us? With the passing of time, we have become so easygoing, so conformed, so well settled, so well reclined, that frankly, God is a figment of the life of ours that comes into being once a week, maybe, or once a month, maybe, or maybe Easter time, or just Christmas. So that millions and millions and millions of Americans that have had a true, honest, biblical background today don't even believe in the miracles of the Bible. I mean, things have gone so well for them that why need God? If you've got it well, where does God come into the picture? You're not going to cry out and ask God to give you a house if you're living in a $1 million mansion. In fact, many don't cry out and ask God for help when they're living in a $5,000 home. So it happens that as long as things are well for us, as long as we're settled, as long as we're moving along, as long as we're halfway making out, God becomes an excess, redundant. So, okay, Lord, when I need you, I'll call on you. That'll be when I die. Give me another 50 years. And on and on and on life goes. And we slowly, slowly dry up spiritually because of our abundance of everything that we have. Such is the case in North America. Is it possible that God is only the God of the poor? Now, in asking myself the question, in analyzing my own situation, I live in the United States of America. I was born in Puerto Rico with missionary parents, lived there for 15 years. Spanish is my first language. Should you detect a slight Spanish accent, it does not come from the name Finkenbinder. Married my wife, and together a year or so after we were married, we went to El Salvador, Central America. Lived in Salvador for 21 years till 1964. At that time, we moved to Costa Mesa because by that time, I was already heavily into radio and it became easier on an international basis to work radio from here than from down there. We've been living in Costa Mesa ever since. So I live in the States. I have my home there, offices there, studios there. We live in the States. Travel by air. The normal conveniences of the United States. You know what they are. So how does one solve this problem? Again, we all know that the spiritually speaking and scripturally speaking, purely from an academic standpoint, God is there all the time. But how do you handle your problem? It's not God's, it's ours. How do we handle our problem of becoming so sophisticated and so tied down to material things that God becomes superfluous to us? How do we handle that problem? We handle it by obligating ourselves to get out onto limbs to where God has to come to our rescue, or the limb that we have gotten out onto is going to break and tear us apart. We place ourselves in positions where we have to have God's rescue or else. It was 1959. Television came to San Salvador. And when TV came to San Salvador, I thought to myself, boy, this is it, television. I could be in front of the cameras, point my finger at the President of the Republic and say, sir, you need to accept Jesus Christ in your heart as your personal Savior, or you and your whole nation is doomed. And I thought, man, what a chance. And of course, only one TV station. I mean, you had them eating out of your hands, and it was a brand new thing. And the fact of the matter is that despite the fact that most of the people who had TVs were peoples of the upper strata of society, who I wanted to reach anyhow, yet many, many poor people were buying TVs. They didn't have a bed, but you'd see an antenna sprouting out of their straw shack. I've seen this many, many times. Anybody that's been south of the border has seen this. Antennas, TV antennas, sprouting up out of straw shacks. You wonder how they can do it. Somehow they do. When TV came, I thought, boy, I've got to be on the air, television. Now, I have been on radio already for 5 years. For 4 years, 1959 this is, for 4 years. And YSU, the station YSU San Salvador, and at the cost of about, at that time, already by this time, $200 or $300 a month. When I began to talk about TV, it turned out to be about $300, including production costs and station time, $300 a week. A week. Well, $300 a week for a missionary living on the field. You don't have access to the public. You're down there by yourself, isolated from the world, and especially isolated from the world that has money. And I said, boy, $300 a week. How can I do it? And yet, deep down inside, I felt that I had to. I just felt that I had to. And finally, one day, I said, I'm going to try my wings. How I'll hack it, I don't know, but I'm going to try my wings. Somehow we'll get by, even if it's for a short time. So I went to the station and asked them, told them that I wanted to go on TV. We had already halfway talked about it before. They said, fine, we have a spot for you. Sunday night, 7:30 to 8, fabulous hour. Sunday night, 7:30 to 8. Incidentally, this was all live. There was no videotape at that time. They didn't even know what a videotape was. And it was all black and white. And all live, very crude, very elementary, but it was the start of TV in Latin America, or in Salvador, and for that matter, in Latin America. So I thought, well, I'm going to try it. So I went down, asked about the time, when could we sign contracts? They said, come back on Monday. This was the latter part of the week previous. Come back on Monday, Hermano Pablo, and we'll have the contract made out. I went back on Monday. Contract was made out. Put it in my hands. I took it to one corner of the office and studied it down, looked at it. It was rather superfluous because I had signed the same type of contract for radio each time. So there, I already knew what it was. Except for one thing, I had not considered the duration of the contract. It was all on there, including the price, $300, including production costs and station time per week. Everything written out very clearly. And I came to the duration of contract. Duración de contrato. And they had filled it out. Un año. 1 year. And I said, 1 year. Now that's 52 weeks, I said to myself. 300 times 52. Well, I'm a lousy mathematician. That stands in good stead, incidentally, for steps of faith. It's good to be a bad mathematician. So I had that on my side, at least. And I thought, boy, do I sign it or don't I sign it? However much it is, it's got to be an awful lot of money. More than what I could ever imagine. $300 a week. $300 was more than I needed for everything for a whole month for my whole life. I mean, arroz and frijoles and enchiladas and tortillas and tacos. The whole bit for the whole month. I mean, it was more than I needed for the whole month. So $300 a week was a ridiculous amount for me. If they had said $3,000 a week, I would not have been any more alarmed. It would not have required any more faith for $3,000 a week for me than $300 a week. I didn't have it. And times 52, forget it. Impossible. But I said, Lord, do I sign this? I said, if I can have some confirmation from you, that'll settle it for me. Do I sign this or don't I sign it? And heaven was blank. I mean, dark. No response at all. I said, please, God, you got to let me know, do I sign it? And I have a little private arrangement with the Lord. When things are His will, there's a very beautiful, uplifting high. An exhilaration that hits me, that makes me feel like $1 million. When things are not His will, there's a horrible, clammy, wet, dungeony gloom that kind of just falls over me, you know. And boy, you can tell the difference. And I said, okay, Lord, you know our arrangement. Either the gloom or the exhilaration. Do I sign the contract or don't I sign the contract? Nothing. Nothing. I said, please, God, you've got to let me know. I just don't dare to do this. 300 times 52, it's ridiculous, God. I can't do it. You've got to let me know. Do I sign it or don't I sign it? Nothing. Silence so deep and thick that you could cut it. Finally, it began to shine through. And it was in the silence. The silence, in fact, was the message. It wasn't in the silence. The silence was the message. When I finally caught on, the silence itself was the message. And here was the message that the silence spoke out, that God through the silence spoke out to me. Son, I'm leaving it up to you. Oh, better no message at all. I said, God, I can't. I can't. If it's on my own, God, I can't. And you know what the Lord said to me? Fine. Don't sign it then. But I said, God, what do you mean don't sign it? The fabulous opportunity we have here of reaching El Salvador for you through television. It'll be a first in the country for the gospel of Christ. And God says, fine, sign it then. And I said, but Lord, $300 a week times 52? Well, don't sign it then. Again, I said, Lord, but I've got to sign this thing. I mean, it's a matter of life or death for millions of people. Well, then sign it. I could never get God off the edge of the thing. He'd fall one way or the other according to the way I went. I could never throw the balance to my side or even to the other side. I'd say, God, I'm scared. He'd say, don't sign it. I said, Lord, I want to sign it. He'd say, sign it. Well, finally, I went over to the desk, pulled out my pen. Now, in normal signature, somebody wants your autograph, or one of those things, I just say Hermano Pablo. In fact, I abbreviate it. H-N-O, which stands for Hermano, just Paul, P-A-B-L-O. And that's all I've gone by in Latin America, Hermano Pablo. My ministry is called Hermano Pablo Ministries. I've stuck with that simply because, let's face it, Finkenbinder. This. You know, I love the name. It'll be with me till I die, and I honor it because my father gave it to me, but it just doesn't sound Spanish, let's face it, you know. And I went to the desk, put the contract down, pull out my pen, and signed it completely. Now, this means signing my name, and in Latin America, you also have to sign your mother's maiden name along with it. Your name is not complete with that, so in my case, it turns out to be Paul Edwin Finkenbinder Argetsinger. I gave it to you all so that you could understand that anywhere along there, I could have stopped at any one of those syllables. I had plenty of chances not to complete the contract, but I stuck with it heavy and hard and steadfastly and strong. Paul Edwin Finkenbinder Argetsinger, and filled out the contract and turned it in. I tell you, I had no idea how on earth things were going to come out. The first thing he said to me, Hermano Pablo, when are you going to start? I said, as soon as possible. A ridiculous thing, because not only did I not have the money, I didn't know anything about TV. I didn't know what I was going to do on the first program. I had no idea of anything. I was just one of the, like Jehu, who started running without the message in his hand. You know, because he had to run. I was just running because I had to run. He said, how about next Sunday? This is Monday. How about next Sunday? And I said, fine, next Sunday. And walked out of there scratching my head, saying to myself, what on earth have I gotten myself into? I began to prepare the first telecast, which incidentally from the very, very, very beginning. This has been with me for a long, long time. I thought the first thing I have to do is put on Bible drama. It's got to be Bible drama. I want to present the Bible in drama. So I brought together some fellows and we started studying. We worked on a script, did a half hour script of a Bible dramatic presentation. This is live, mind you, absolutely live. I mean, you can't, there's no way of saying cut because you're on the air live, you know. There's no cut. You got to go all the way through. Once the camera opens up on you, you've got 30 minutes and you've got to live with the 30 minutes. Whatever happens, there is no cut. Like there is no cut in life, incidentally. Anyway, we were doing pretty good. I forget what the first story was about. Do you happen to remember what that first story might have been, hon? Oh, it started out with that, didn't it? Oh, yes, that's right. It started out with that. I started out with an interview type thing of businessmen giving testimonies. Then I went into the Bible dramas. We were writing a script, getting it laid out, setting up, when on Wednesday morning, I hear a knock at the door. And I go to the door, and there stands at the door a man whom I had known before, had flown with him, in fact, in his own plane, but never expected to see him in Salvador. He was from Sunnyside, Washington. Leslie Richards, who's now with the Lord. Leslie Richards. And I said, Les, what on earth are you doing here? Latter part of December of 1959. I said, what brings you to Salvador? Well, he said, I got a little tired and thought I'd take some time off and got my plane, flew to Guatemala yesterday, was there with the Haitians yesterday, and I come over today to see you. Can I come in? I said, of course, come in. Well, for those days, I had divorced my wife and I had married television. So everything I slept, ate, or drank, or talked, or dreamed, or thought was television. So anybody that would come across my path, I would fill them with the new venture that we had in our hearts and minds. Television. So I did with him. Never once mentioned the money part. I was so engrossed with the ministry that the money part I forgot about. Besides that, I had 30 days to come up with the money. So why start worrying about it from the very beginning? So I filled him with TV. TV here, TV there. Everything was TV. The morning passed. We went to the lunch table. I went to wash my hands. He was already sitting down, my wife and children and Leslie, and he was my chair. I came and sat down and saw as I sat down by my chair a check upside down by my chair. I saw it. I knew it was a check, even though it was upside down. How does one recognize a check? Even though it's upside down, you get to where you recognize a check, even edgewise, you know. Not that you see that many of them, but because you see so few of them. At least back in my time. And what can you do? You know, the guy's right there beside you. You can't pick it up and look at it with the guy right there beside you, you know. So I said a prayer for the meal. And that's kind of a flexible thing, you know, that you can stretch out and bring in as you will. You know, I stretched it out as far as I could, trying to ward off the impasse as far as I possibly could, you know. Finished praying, started to eat. Of course, you know all along that he's thinking that you're thinking what he's thinking. You know, and vice versa. So there's nothing to hide. The impasse is there and the feelings are there, but you know that he's thinking what you're thinking anyhow, you know. So finally, you have to face issues. Somewhere down the line, you've got to face issues. So I picked it up and looked at it, turned it over. And I cried. And it wasn't so much the amount. If the amount happened to me, it's only the largest check that I had ever received from any individual in all of my lifetime up to that time. It covered one telecast and two-thirds of another telecast, $500. But it wasn't so much the amount. It was to me the miracle of God. As though the check had been left in blank. And as though the signature down there was Jehovah Jireh, the Lord will provide. And I saw in that check, in that single check, the provision for the whole year of telecasting. I knew this was the answer. I knew this was the answer. Well, I don't want to make that much of the financial end of it, though I will tell you that we did go the second week and the third and the fourth and the fifth and the sixth and the eighth and the tenth and the 20th and the 30th and the 40th, and if we finish a year, and God miraculously, I don't know from where, some months it had to be $1,200, other months $1,500, but God miraculously from here and there supplied the need and we finish out the year. I had to come home on furlough at that time, so that was the end of telecasting for me. Because they had to be live and there was no videotape. You couldn't tape ahead of time. And that was it. But I bring it out to you because for me it represented a step of faith that I need not have taken. I was okay. My $300 a month that I was getting was covering my tortillas and frijoles and enchiladas. And as far as ministry was concerned, all I had to do was step across the street and minister in our churches nearby right there in San Salvador. Or the country of Salvador. And it doesn't cost very much. It doesn't take much gas, you know, to get on the back of a mule and traipse across the country of Salvador, which I've done many, many times. So it wasn't a case of needing it, except for the call of God upon my heart, and except for the fact that that year, I remember, I was very, very, very close to God. And I don't have to explain why. When you're looking at a bill without any resource at all, no idea where the money is coming from $1,200 to $1,500 a month, when you're looking at that every single month, not having any idea where it's going to come from, you exercise faith. It places you in a position of being able to exercise faith. Without faith, it's impossible to please God. Without areas of need, it's impossible to have faith. Let me run that one through again. Without faith, it's impossible to please God. And without darkness in your life, without problems in your life, without difficulties in your life, without trials in your life, without deficits in your life, without these things in your life that cause you to have faith, it's impossible to have faith. So if you don't have faith, you don't please God. If you don't have problems, you don't have faith. What happens? We dry up. We dry up. So it becomes a fact that needs for us, problems for us, difficulties for us, challenges for us, are thrusts of faith that God takes advantage of to keep us very close to Him. And God is pleased with it, and we are pleased with it. Conclusion, if you've got a problem, don't spend days and days and days and days mourning over it and being sour about it and being bitter about it and being hateful about it and being complaining about it and being critical about it, critical of other people that you say should be helping you. Nobody owes us anything. Nobody owes us anything. Nobody owes us anything. I first went on the air on radio in 1955. Just like TV, I signed the contract without having any idea of where the money would come from. And why did you do it, Paul? Not because I was thinking that I needed faith, frankly. You don't do it because of that. I did it because of a thrust in my heart that I couldn't help it. I was driven to it. I just driven to it, driven to it, driven to it. 2 weeks after being on the air, in that case, it was $136 a month or $133 a month. I didn't have it. 2 weeks after going on the air, a man by the name of Roy Stewart, an emissary, as a matter of fact, of Brother Noah, was in Salvador preaching our pastor's retreat. He saw that I was on the air. He said, Paul, how are you supporting the program? I said, I'm not supporting the program. He said, beautiful, how can you be on the air? I said, I don't know. I said, maybe because I have 2 more weeks before I have to come up with the first payment. He wrote a letter that night to Brother Noah. I had never met Brother Noah. Didn't know who he was. And he showed me the letter. In it, he asked Brother Noah if he could help with $140 a month. That left $7 for taping costs. This was now radio, not television. And I was elated. I said, oh, fantastic. This is the answer. God, how beautiful you are. But then the letter came to the States, and Brother Stewart went further on into Honduras, South America, Central America, and I was left in the middle of this vacuum, and I thought of all the letters I'd written, and nobody had answered. Why should one letter bring the answer? Especially when I had been asking for $5, and nobody had answered, and this was asking for $140 from a single man. Impossible! But at the end of the month, there was a check from Brother Noah for $140, which kept coming, and as a matter of fact, increasing for 17 years solid. Now, I say that to you, Christians, to tell you that the times of need that we thrust ourselves into for the sake of the ministry of the gospel of Christ are not only honored by God by way of supplying the need, they're honored by God by way of giving us fertile ground in which to grow and exercise faith. I told you yesterday about my wife's foot. She fell down a couple months ago, in case you weren't here. Some of you might have been. Fell down a couple months ago and broke her ankle. The ankle is mended. Put a couple of screws into it and to tie the ankle to the leg bone because it was shattered, absolutely shattered. Some chips couldn't even be found a place for. Shattered. The ankle is mended 2.5 months ago now. But because of not using the leg muscles are atrophied. And she can't stand on it now, barely stand on it now, not because of the ankle, but because of the leg. What happens to us when we find ourselves in situations where we can't exercise faith because all of everything is provided? We've got everything we need. We don't have any needs. What happens to us? We become flabby, spiritually flabby. We lose our strength. We lose our faith. And without faith, it is impossible to please God. So Christians, it is important for us to fight. It's important for us to have to exercise. It's important for us to be in situations where we must have to trust God. It's important for us to have needs. It's important for us to have needs. It's important for us, for our spiritual strength, for our growth, for our stature, for our relationship to God. It's important for us to have needs. I thank God for what He'll do for us, and the promises are in His Word for us, and thank the Lord for that. But if I, from this day on, to the day that I died, never again had any kind of a need whatsoever, you tell me, what kind of a Christian servant do you think I would be? I'll answer you, a flabby, useless piece of pulp. That's right. It's needs that keep us strong, that make us exercise, like the runner that doesn't just run the day of the race, but he runs to keep himself under subjection every day of his life, many, many a mile, so that when the day of the race comes, he's strong enough to run. So needs are for us that very element. Without faith, it is impossible to please God. And without a need, there can be no faith. So thank God for your problems. Accept them. And with joy and with happiness, say, God, I'm hanging in there with you. It's all right, Lord. You'll become strong. And each one will be a stronger need and a stronger problem and a stronger difficulty because you can take more. And what lessons that leaves you for your own life and what lessons that leaves you for other people's lives. So Christians, don't shun the difficulties. Don't shun the problems. Don't shun the trials. Use them. Use them. Use them for your own good. God bless you. And thank you.
This has been a prime time message from the International Tape Library of Hermano Pablo Ministries.